Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, covering the stories in the new world of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks to a legend in the history of education choice, Professor Jack Koons of Berkeley Law. Now 92 years old, Koons and his partner Stephen Sugarman are the institutional founders of the progressive wing of the education choice movement. Koons has compiled some of his timeless writing into a new book, School Choice and the Human Good. The two discuss the book and Koons' long history fighting for choice and equity, including the incredible true story of how the 1978 Jonestown Massacre forever altered the history of education choice in America. Thank you for listening, and enjoy this very special episode.
So I'm really excited to have as my guest Jack Koons, who is out with a new book. The book is entitled School Choice and the Human Good. A little bit of background about Professor Koons, who is a legend, of course, in the school choice movement. You've been a leader, Jack, for what, 50 plus years in the movement. A lot of us have been excited to know you and to learn from you. And so I just want to tell you how excited I am to do this interview.
When you give me a second, I'll tell you how excited I am to be with you, Doug Tuthill, who has created one of the most interesting, place of choice and hope in Florida. And your remarkable colleagues, Ron Matus, Donna Winchester, John East, and so forth, thank you for allowing me over these years to do this.
Well, it's been really an honor. The word honor is not strong enough, Jack. We've all been blessed to be with you, and it's exciting to do this interview. Let me just give our listeners a little bit of background. Not everybody is as lucky as me to know the Jack Koons story, but you're a law professor emeritus at UC Berkeley. You've had a very distinguished career there. You've written a couple of choice books, certainly with your former student and good friend, Steve Sugarman. Steve and I did a long interview about a year ago, and he's just an amazing, amazing man. And I know he's been a great partner for you for decades.
Steve is great.
You guys wrote in 1978, you published probably one of the most influential books ever in the choice movement, Education by Choice. In 1999, you published Making School Choice Work for All Families. And what's been really interesting about your approach, Jack, is you've always looked at this issue from a moral perspective. And I kind of want to start there, if you don't mind. I found the title of the book kind of interesting, School Choice and the Human Good. So let's start there. You see this issue from a moral perspective. So talk a little bit about how you see choice and how you see it as part of the human good and how you see it as a moral issue.
You have to decide what is human, and you have to have a sense that there is a human responsibility. We all carry something which makes us responsible for our own choices. Sometimes we make mistakes, honest mistakes, that's fine. But we're responsible not just for our choices then, but for the choices that we try to make because they look good. Now, we can't avoid mistakes. That's something else again. In any case, that's what I'm about. And the good is, you can imagine it being done by dictators for people, and that's pretty much what we've got in the public school system for poor people. If you live in the city, you go to that school and you don't get a chance to go anywhere else, unlike the well-to-do people. Now, that too is a moral question. Should we deprive people of the right to, which they have, a constitutional right, to decide where their child goes to school because they can't afford to go to the school of their choice? We've done that since 1840, and it seems to me almost criminal, but at least it seems to me immoral. It was designed originally to keep the people coming off the boats, keep them out of trouble, and make them more like Horace Mann. And that particular attitude has gone right on and been taken over by the school systems, the public school systems, as part of their mission. That is to take over the folks who are poor. And I know you asked me to talk about morality, but not, so at least those two things. That is to say, the responsibility of the parent for their own child is first, and not just because it's made in heaven, though that may be, but that it's good for the child. And that is, I mean, not every child. Parents make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. But at least some identified human being should be making the decision for Joe or Nancy. That's somebody that they know, and somebody who knows the child. That is a moral proposition, instead of having it made by nobody, which is the case for our public school in the inner city today. It's also a problem that can be fixed. It's not an amazing proposition to say, well, give people subsidies if they're poor and can't, or low income. I mean, when I say poor, I better be careful, because it could mean anybody who can't afford to pay to move to a rich school district. That maybe is the lower half of all our citizens. I'm not sure, but so, you know, roughly, to paint them into a corner where they have no option but to do this. And why do we do it? Why do we in the suburbs? What makes us think that we're doing justice when we tell our less lucky neighbors, you go here, and you don't even question that? You just send your child to PS 36 and that's it. Well, that's wrong. In my judgment, that is immoral.
You wrote a piece in your book about some of the choices you and your wife made as parents for your kids.
Yes.
And I had the sense that the choices that you made, and like you said, you're blessed. You've had a fantastic professional career, and you've been able to be comfortable and raise an amazing family. But you guys made choices for your kids, sometimes in district schools, sometimes in private schools. How much did that influence your views that it shouldn't just be the Jack Coons of the world that have that opportunity, that every family ought to have that opportunity?
First of all, you have to understand that a couple of my children were school teachers.
And right.
They taught in the inner city. My wife was a school teacher.
When they were growing up and you put them in school, you put them in a combination of schools. And so I'm wondering if your ability to do that helped motivate you to want other families to have the same opportunities that you had as a father.
Here's our situation. We moved from Northwestern University in Chicago just as our kids were, you know, really getting into the school thing. And we were facing the question, should we live in a nice suburb just outside of Berkeley, or should we come into Berkeley? We decided that we would like to go to Berkeley and join in the crowd. Look, that's just an attitude. That's what I believed in. I can't tell you exactly why, maybe my religion or something. But anyway, we thought we would do both. We would try out. First, we would try out with our elder kids, who were then 10 years old, something like that, put them in local schools, the local public schools. And we tried that, and we loved it for the local school. The first school, the elementary school. Our experience with the middle schools was not so good. It was really, you know, all of these schools now were racially integrated. And eventually, we just felt it was unfair to the kids to have them experience this way. So they went to religious schools for a while, and in total over the years, we totted it up one time, and we had something like, 50-50.
Right.
Almost exactly even amount of years, not by design, so I could tell you this.
Right.
I'm not a political hero. We're trying to do the best for our kids and behave, as you say, morally at the same time. We weren't ducking out. So I'm glad we did. And we did it in Europe, too. When we were there, I had a sabbatical once, and we took all different kinds of schools, and not that there was quite the same problem, but
I guess I was just curious if that experience helped motivate you to want to have other families that had those same opportunities. You could afford a Catholic school, for example, but a lot of families can't.
I went to Catholic schools as a kid. And we could afford it, even though my dad lost his job in the Depression. It was the tuition was $2 a month. And the nuns were teaching, of course.
Yeah,
they were not taking big salaries.
No, they weren't. No.
I suppose they added something substantively to my soul to care for people who didn't have any money.
Yeah.
We didn't really at that time, but we got, we came out of the Depression and then the war and everything brought us back up. But also external events were very important, things that I could never choose that just happened to me. And that the main thing was in 1962, one of my colleagues at Northwestern, Willard Pedrick, was offered a job. The federal government asked him to look at Chicago Public Schools and see whether they're cheating on the blacks.
Right.
And he turned it down. He said, "Why don't you call Coons? He's got five kids. He needs some money. So I said yes. And I didn't know a thing about public schools, of course, having been almost always in Catholic schools. But in a way, it helped me because I got to look at this thing without any experience whatsoever, and it was horrific to me. I saw it as self-important people at the top of a big system pushing other people around, and worst of all, when you got down to the school size where they were all separated by race, and later I was going to be surprised to discover that the money thing was not so different. Chicago had lots of money. They were a well-off district. What didn't occur to me was that this was just all this going on within one district. It slowly dawned on me that other districts were very poor. And others were richer even than Chicago. And I got fascinated with this, which led to our interest in inter-district discrimination. And so Steve Sugarman and Bill Kloon came along, and my students, and we wrote a book together called Private Wealth and Public Education, in which we damned the district system, which some districts had lots of money at low tax rates, and some districts, for example, Emeryville here in California, we looked at it in the charts when we wrote our book. This must be a rich house. I mean, that this must be a place where the rich people live. Well, when we got here, of course, it was a, what shall I say? I won't say anything except it was all poor people. But they had a huge financial base because of the industry that was there. So they had a low tax rate, but they spent huge amounts. Well, anyway, that story got us a feeling that we had to do something. So we wrote a book. And in due course, when we came out to California, Steve and I got involved. He moved here too. And we argued the Serrano case. I don't know if you know about Serrano. Sure. But anyway, Now, that didn't even touch the issue that you and I are talking about, of course. That was inter-district discrimination.
That was you're looking at financial inequalities based on the tax bases in different communities. Yeah.
That's it. But it finally it occurred to us that poor people, wherever they were, mostly in the cities, but wherever they lived, they were getting the short end of it because they didn't have any choice about where they went to school. Well, I was making choices constantly with my family and watching other rich people do the same. So anyhow, Steve and I decided we better do something. Of course, I knew Milton Friedman already. That helped because I had a radio program in Chicago every week, half an hour, and Milton was frequently on my program. And we argued with one another about how to finance schools and who was getting cheated and who was, you know. We never came to agreement exactly, but we both agreed that poor people ought to be helped. What I had trouble with was doing this for everybody who didn't need it. I've come around to partly to what he suggested. That is to say, it would not be so bad if we gave Rockefellers a subsidy to send their child to a private school. But I'd rather not do that. It just seems to me unnecessary. But that's okay. If it's necessary politically, that's fine. And anyhow, we got out here. It turned out we both went to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay. And he lived in San Francisco and I in Berkeley. We got together again and chummed up a bit. And Steve Sugarman and I had decided that we would try to blow up the system again in a different way. And we designed in the early 70s, actually our first book was in 1970, I think. It was a piece in the long, long piece in the California Library, boring as hell. But anyway, it described a theoretical legal structure for vouchers. And then we did it again, as you mentioned, in Education by Choice, which we wrote and published in 1978. Now, 1978 was a classic year for us. It's typical of what happened to vouchers in California. I was in church one day, and I met a lady, and she said, "Oh, give your book to my cousin, Leo Ryan." Leo Ryan was a congressman who, a Democrat, by the way, down the peninsula south of San Francisco. And anyway, Leo and I got together, and we became pals, and we decided we would design a law to be put on the books here. Leo said, I will do the political stuff. And here is my agent, such and such, a lady who is still in the Congress, by the way, today. So the three of us had this plan. Leo and his two, and Steve and I, and we would draft it. And he would get it passed, and so on. She would do the hard work. Now, of course, Leo made a mistake. He said, "I'll be here. No, I have to make a little trip before I get back home, but then we'll get going." And of course, he got himself killed in Guyana. So we never saw him again. And then one day, a bishop called me up, a certain bishop. I won't name this particular person, but anyway, big shot, and said, "Maybe we could come up with $2 million for a program. If you draft it, and we'll see what we can do." Yeah. Well, in the end, after I'd committed myself to this again, this experience, The bishops decided after several months of my dealing with all of the other, including Cesar Chavez and a whole lot of other people, concluded that their people, our people are not ready for it. Oh, okay. So I was stuck then. Steve and I were stuck with what was left of this wretched system that we'd put together. And we never made it to the ballot, of course. So those were bad days. I mean, as you can tell, but they were, in a way, they were like a movie. You just, it happens. This is what life is about. So anyway.
Can I interrupt for a moment? I just want to summarize for our listeners, because this is an amazing story. In California, the bluest of blue states, which today is fiercely opposed to any kind of parental empowerment or education choice, a liberal Democrat from the San Francisco area joined up with two Berkeley law professors to develop a strategy to introduce vouchers statewide to California. You guys wrote the language, were ready to go. The fact that you had a liberal Democrat congressman, very popular, very skilled politically, going to lead the charge, meant that you had a good shot of getting this done. And he goes down and gets murdered at Guyana in the Jonestown fiasco. And the entire history of the choice movement is affected. I mean, that's just an amazing story. That is a movie. I mean, that you can see that's an amazing story.
And there are other aspects, but you know, I had an interesting span of years there during which we were trying like mad, and we never seemed to get Milton Friedman on our side. We thought we had him in 1978, and then we discovered at the last minute that the rich guys who were going to help us were helping him instead with an opposing referendum. So Milton and I had our troubles, but anyway, God bless him. I hope he's okay.
I want to understand exactly how you and Milton Friedman disagreed. I know you guys, as you said, debated each other and discussed it for years on your radio show and in other forums.
And in his, by the way, on his television show too.
On his television show also. So he was basically a free market guy, and he was taking approach from a market perspective, and you were looking at it from a moral perspective and a justice perspective, and so you guys differed in terms of your approach, and I presume that the real difference was in regulation. You probably wanted more regulation, and he was probably more of a libertarian, less regulation. Is that a fair assessment?
You got it. And there's another. They're running another one this year. I mean, there is at this moment a very complicated initiative, popular initiative, that is so complicated you'll never get through it. And I've had trouble understanding it all. But anyway, it is clearly not. It's clearly Milton that's right. doing the work. And look, he's a good guy. I can't say we didn't get along sometimes, and sometimes we did.
While we're talking about characters in your life, I want to just pause for a minute and talk a little bit about Albert Schenker. You and Schenker, for listeners, Albert Schenker, a fairly famous teacher union president. He led the famous New York City strike in the early 60s, which basically ultimately led to the whole teacher union movement. He was president of the American Federation for Teachers, which is a large national union. And you and he debated this issue quite a bit. And I know he's famous for a quote which basically said, and you mentioned in your book, "When kids start paying dues, I'll start representing kids."
Yes.
Talk a little bit about your perspective in terms of Schenker and your back and forth with him. Was it basically the union business model that caused him to say, look, I just can't embrace parental empowerment and school choice? Is that basically what's going on there?
Well, I think so. He and I knew each other from President Jimmy Carter days. We were on his forum together. I've forgotten the name of it, but anyway, we got to know each other, and we liked each other, I think. I mean, I liked him, certainly. In fact, he's had dinner in this house. He's deceased, of course. But anyway, I used to tell him that my point of view, of course, and you mentioned his favorite line, which is when kids start paying union dues, that's when I'll start representing them. Well, of course, they do pay union dues. What would his union be if they didn't go to public school? That is his bread and butter, is the kids coming to his school. So I always love to boast about that, give him the rib about that. And he and Milton and I argued on Milton's television show over this kind of stuff. And that is still available, by the way, the particular television program. I'm talking too much, but anyway.
That's a great story. You had a great quote that our friend Ron Matus put in the preface, which is a beautifully written preface. Ron Matus adores you like a lot of us do.
I'm thankful, and whatever Ron Matus does is okay with me.
He's okay with a lot of us. But you had this beautiful quote, and I just want to share it and have you talk a little bit more about it. The family needs the chance to regain the muscle that atrophied when the state plucked its authority. Basically, the idea that the families are the strength of the families are eroded when they don't have the authority to decide how their children should be educated. So I want you to talk a little bit about more. I've heard you talk a lot about the effect of choice on families. Most people think about it just in terms of kids, but you think about the entire family and the impact of choice on families, or the impact of lack of choice on families, which is why I think this quote is so beautiful. Regain the muscle of the atrophied when they lost the power to control how their kids are educated. Talk a little bit more about how you see that, where that thought came from.
Of course, from experience. I have 5 children,
right,
and a lot of experience. But also, I have to imagine what it's like to be poor. I've had a lot of experience with the poor. There are 3 things that you should think about. One is the effect on the child himself, herself. Secondly, the effect on the parents and the rest of the family. And third is the effect on society. Now, as for the child, it seems to me, I haven't been a child for a long time, but it seems to me that if you see your parent, as opposed to other parents, being treated as a nobody and taking you and sending you off to a school that they didn't want you to go to, you begin to think, well, who's running my life? Who is my friend? And you begin to see the parent and marriage, I think, as a very inane institution, maybe even doing the work of the government. The government says, have children so we can send them to our school. Well, the effect on the child's attitude toward family and marriage is very, in my view, I'm just imagining this, but it seems to me it is extremely destructive. And it is extremely destructive on the parent who sees herself, himself, as a nobody. You mean I can't get my kid, I can't send my kid to this other school or next PS 32 instead of 29? And I say yes, unless you move there. And of course, then if you move there, you have to have some money. And pretty soon you're up in Beverly Hills for a few of us who have lots of money. And it's not the way to run a democracy. It just is horrible example for children and parents to see themselves as nobodies simply because they don't have a lot of money. They have the right, the constitutional right, but they don't have the money. So I would just hope that somehow, oh, by the way, it seems to me the third victim is the civil order. The children, what about, why should I be hanging around this family? Or why should I have a family? Why, we'll just, you know, do whatever we want to do. And you wind up with a civil order that is totally out of whack with respect to not only the lower class parent, but we who make them that way, they say, you go there.
One of my favorite stories is, this has happened to me a couple times, where I've had a grandmother reach out to me who has a grandchild that she's raising, and the child's on a scholarship program, at one of our scholarship programs, and the child has been failing in school and hanging out with the wrong kind of kids, really on a bad path. Kid gets on a scholarship, goes to a new school, has complete transformation. You know, the life has changed, our life trajectory has changed. The grandmother is so excited about it that the grandmother goes back to school to work on her GED because she figures, okay, I need to show an example for my grandchild. And I'm so excited about you know, my grandchild's progress. Maybe I can do this too. So every time I read about you're talking about this, I always think about those examples because it's the whole family ecosystem that is affected. When I talk to these grandmothers going back to school, it's just so powerful. And it just reinforces what you've always taught me, which is the entire family ecosystem is impacted when you feel disempowered and have no hope. And the scholarships and choice and empower gives people hope. And that's why the grandmothers go back and work on their GEDs.
That's a wonderful tale. Yeah. I really, and let me say, we admire what you guys do so much. Whoever we is, I do anyway. So please don't ever stop.
Well, thank you. So, you know, the new book basically is a series of columns that you've written over like a decade. Some of them you wrote as part of the American Center for School Choice. But most of them you wrote really is a blessing for us as part of Step Up. First with our Redefined blog, which has now been named Reimagined as we move to begin to reimagine public education. And so it's a phenomenal body of work. People need to take a look at the book, School Choice and the Human Good. There's probably, I don't know, 60 or 70 essays in there that are just extraordinary. And So I just want to let people know that that's a powerful piece, and I hope they take a look at it. Let's fast forward. Pardon me?
I'm honored.
Oh, well, we are too, very much. I'm curious about how you see things today. You mentioned that there's a ballot initiative in California, which people are pushing. During the pandemic, a lot of states started passing school choice legislation. In Florida today, we have almost 190,000 children on scholarship. We're getting 150 applications a day at Step Up still, and it's November, so you think people would slow down. So there's something happening. So I'm just curious how you see it. I mean, you've been leading this fight for 50 plus years. You know, you work with ML King, you debated Milton Friedman, you and Steve Sugarman came close to changing trajectory of the movement in California. Today, how do you see things? Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? Do you feel like, I'm just curious about how you see things today.
Of course, a lot depends on the universe of politics. Yeah. And I can't predict. But on the other hand, I think that you guys are making immense progress. And as I look at Florida particularly, I am just amazed at what you have been able to do. Somehow we've got to get the language straightened out. You are the liberals. You are opening up democracy for the poor. And so long as people yell and scream at you guys as a bunch of fascists because you happen to be for choice, let them look in the mirror. The teachers' unions and so forth, particularly, not all of them maybe, and certainly not the teachers themselves. You know, I don't want to damn everybody because I don't know everybody, but it is wrong, it seems to me, to fight against charter schools and vouchers and so forth on the ground that it's a right-wing conspiracy. It is it is a left-wing conspiracy. That's what it is, to help poor people, ordinary people, live their lives as human beings with respect. End of speech.